Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Ugly Things Podcast. I'm Mike Stacks, the editor and publisher of Ugly Things magazine. I'm excited about today's episode because we'll be going deep into one of my all-time favorite records, the debut album by Moby Grape. Originally released in June 1967, this West Coast wonder is in regular rotation at my house, especially during the summer months, and it never gets old. There's not a weak song on it. Every one of them is a winner. Moby Grape was a mercurial, multi-headed monster. Five singers, five songwriters, three guitarists. Jerry Miller, Peter Lewis, and Skip Spence, and one of the tightest, most dynamic rhythm sections of the era, bass player Bob Moseley and drummer Don Stevenson. In this episode, Don Stevenson talks about how the band first came together in 1966 and about the writing and recording of their debut masterpiece. Also on board for the conversation is Cam Cobb, author of the great Moby Grape biography, What's Big and Purple and Lives in the Ocean, and also an upcoming book about Skip Spence. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm here today with Don Stevenson of Moby Grape and Cam Cobb, who is the biographer of Moby Grape and an expert on the band. So let's talk about how the band first came together, because we're talking about five individuals from different backgrounds, different locations. Don, I know you and Jerry were playing together first in the Frantics up in the Pacific Northwest. Maybe you could pick up the story there.
I think just how the band turned into to Moby Grape is kind of interesting. This is after we were in California. The Frantics came down from Washington and Tacoma down to California to play on Broadway. At the time, that was kind of a prestigious thing to do. The Byrds were on Broadway. And after we found out that, you know, Carol Doda was at the Condor and the Byrds had left town and we were backing up topless dancers, we kind of got out of there as soon as we possibly could. And we got a gig in San Francisco again at the Dragon at Go-Go, and we ended up finding Bob Moseley at a gig where Jerry and I went to listen to Joel Scott Hill Trio, and we heard Bob Moseley, and we talked to him, and we hired him to come and play with the Frantics because he was so awesome. He was just amazing. So our saxophone player that was playing with the Frantics at the time, Bob Hosko, went back up to Seattle, and we replaced him with Moseley. So we had the Frantics were playing in San Francisco at the Dragon at Go-Go, and it was a Chinese restaurant, not on Broadway. And we had a nice gig there, and Bob played with us for probably a month or so. And then that gig ran out and Bob left, and Jerry and I went back down to San Mateo, and that was the last we'd heard of Bob, but it was a great experience playing with him. So there was a period of time there where Jerry and I were just playing around on the peninsula, picking up a gig here and there. We had played with Denise Kaufman, and who was from the Ace of Cups. She ended up with the Ace of Cups, and we played with her for a while. She found the club scene relatively, you know, disgusting, but Jerry and I were old, you know, blue-collar club guys, and so we played at the clubs. And one day we got a call from San Francisco Matthew Cates somehow found our phone number and gave us a call. And I guess Matthew was up in San Francisco with Skip, who was the drummer with the Airplane, Skip Spence. And they were going to start a new band. Skip wanted to get out of the Airplane. Or the Airplane wanted to get Skip out of it, however that worked. But anyway, Bob Mosley and Peter Lewis had some prior knowledge of one another. I think Peter knew Matthew, and then Peter knew Bob and invited him up. So they had three pieces, and they needed a drummer. And I think that they wanted another guitar player. So they invited us up for an audition they were holding auditions up in San Francisco for this new band, because in San Francisco there was an amazing scene happening at the time. You know, music was exploding all over the place. People were coming from all over the world to San Francisco because of the energy and the enthusiasm and the change of culture, and something was going on, and the music had a big part of it. So Jerry and I drove up to our appointed date for the audition. So we went in, they had a studio set up where they had speakers and drums and amplifiers and mics and all of that. And so we introduced ourselves. We knew Bob, obviously, because Bob was the one that recommended us, but we didn't know Peter, and we didn't know Matthew, and we didn't know Skip. So we all introduced ourselves to each other, and primarily the way the audition went was we just all kind of played songs that we liked. Like, we were playing songs, Little Richard songs, and, you know, songs from Chuck Berry and, you know, Fats Domino, and, you know, just we were just playing anything that we liked. And we just started playing, and I don't know, it was like we'd been playing together forever. You know, it was just awesome. Singing was good, and playing was good, and sounded good to me. You know, and I was kind of tying in with Bob because we'd played together before. You know, we just locked it in. And so the audition was over. We were supposed to play maybe a couple of songs. We ended up playing for maybe 45 minutes or an hour, just because it was fun. So Jerry and I wanted to be cool, so we left the audition and just said, hey, you know, nice to meet you guys, and, you know, we'll see what happens. You know, it was cool. We had a lot of fun. Thanks. And we got out in the car. We hopped in the Oldsmobile and looked at each other and high-fived and, you know, went, oh, my God, did you hear that? Whoa, that was so, you know. And so we were just thrilled, man. It was, like, cool. We didn't want to be that enthusiastic in front of everybody, but we were. Jerry and I are buddies, so we were pretty excited. You know, I said, well, hope to hell we get that gig. So we went back down to San Mateo and kept playing. A few days later, we just found out that, hey, let's get together because we want you and Jerry to be in the band. And that's kind of how it all got together.
And how soon after that did the name come about?
I think we started to perform at the Arc, but we weren't performing to begin with. To begin with, it was just a rehearsal area.
Yeah.
And so we were down, we moved down to, from San Mateo, we moved up into Mill Valley. Jerry and I moved up into Mill Valley. And this Arc was the name of the abandoned ferry boat that had turned into a restaurant dance floor located in San Francisco. There was a lot of houseboats there, and this kind of really cool old ferry boat that was, you know, like I said, turned into a restaurant and a music venue. After hours venue is what it amounted to. So after we got there, and this, by the way, while we were there, you know, Janis Joplin with Big Brother and the Holding Company and the Buffalo Springfield and Lee Michaels and Moby Grape were all playing there and practicing there and working out all of our songs. Nobody had heard of any of us, and we weren't even playing for quite some time. We were just rehearsing. And so while we were rehearsing, I think Skip came up with the name, or Skip or Bob came up with the name. It was just out of a, you know, just a chapter from an old joke. You know, the old joke was, what's big and purple and swims in the sea? It was, you know, Moby Grape. Or no, it was Moby Grape. It was from Moby Dick, which is big and white and swims in the sea. And so it was just like a ridiculous name. But we were throwing around all kinds of names. And when we came up with that, that was brought on, we all just said, well, you know what? It's like kind of ridiculous, but it's something that people will remember. It'll be remembered. It's unusual. And as I look back, there were kind of two groups of names. There was like kind of cool names. And then there were names like, you know, the Strawberry Alarm Clock and the Prunes. And I think, I'm afraid that Moby Grape might have fallen into the ridiculous name, but we had some vindication because I think everybody that was in it had had some musical chops that could rise above a ridiculous name. But then, of course, Matthew claimed that he thought of it.
So what kind of people were coming to the Ark? I mean, what kind of scene was that?
Well, as I told you, Jerry and I were kind of like grizzled old bar players. You know, we'd play up in Seattle. You'd play at a bar and you'd play there for 6 weeks, six nights a week, from 9 o'clock to 1 o'clock in the morning. So we were just playing all the time. When we got to the Ark and they finally started to open up, we started to play after hours. I was actually shocked because I had never really seen people like, I look out there and, you know, it looked like I was playing for a bunch of water buffaloes. These people had like hair that came out over everywhere, big beards and, you know, girls with big, long, big hair. And, you know, it was just like a scene that for me, it was like out of the Star Wars bar at the time. It was really unusual. But the people were so cool, and they loved to dance, and they loved the after-hours show. And then after I, you know, got initiated a little bit more into the scene through smoking some really nice bud and relaxing a little bit, I just embraced the whole thing. It was really great. But it was an unusual scene because our scene was like after the Avalon and the Fillmore closed and Matrix closed, and people would come over to Sausalito, and we would start, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning and play till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning over there. And then they'd serve breakfast at the Ark. And so it was a pretty cool scene.
Well, sounds like it. At what point did original material start getting into the set? Was that pretty quick? Do you remember what the first songs were?
There was never anything but original material.
So right away when you guys got together, you're all writing.
Yeah. We were rehearsing before we rehearsed at the Ark and actually kind of started the, you know, after hours, we practiced up at Skip's house up in Marin. And at that point, you know, we would practice every day. We would come in and every day somebody would have a new song. We'd come in and say, hey, listen to this, man. And, you know, Bob would come in and lay something down, or Peter or Skip or Jerry and I. And the cooperative sense of, I guess maybe it was just like what was going on in, you know, in the air.
Okay, so in this band, you got 5 singers, 5 songwriters, 3 guitarists, you're all throwing in ideas. Maybe let's talk about 3 guitarists. You got 3 different styles of playing there with Peter and Jerry and Skip. How would you define each of those styles, and how did they work together? Was there any difficulties?
So are you a musician at all? Do you play?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, Michael, you appreciate this. We had, what, 24 strings, and there was no tuning devices. So the first challenge was you had one of these old tuners, metal tuners, you'd bang on your knee and put on the body of the guitar. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, it was a miracle. But we did manage to tune up and be patient enough to where everybody was happy with the tuning. But Peter came from a finger-picking style and kind of from a folk background, right? But he was a pretty accomplished finger-picker, so that was a unique style. And Jerry, just as a solo virtuoso, I mean, and when we were up in Seattle and kind of our basics, we were playing, you know, charts from old standards and, you know, jazz charts, and he was like a big Wes Montgomery fan, and so he was like on the edge of rhythm and blues and jazz. And Skip was just ethereal. So he would just move in and out without a trace of conflict. So it was very unusual. So Skip just found space in the midst of everything else. And Peter picked fingers, did finger picking. And Jerry would, would play, chords and play these great licks. And when Mosley was obviously just like, we used to call him Thumpin' Grump. Man, that guy could like just lay down the bass. I think that's the reason it worked, because I don't think there was any bands at that time that had three guitars. And then all of us sang and all of us wrote, so that became a strength. And again, that's one of the things that created that excitement when we were rehearsing, because you'd come in and you'd bring a song and you'd sing, and the next thing you know, there's people singing harmonies, and then somebody said, why don't we do this? And, Mosley would go, where's that old Mr. Blues? And they'd go, boop, boop, boo! And the next thing you know, we're like the Four Tops, and so there was just, people are singing harmony lines, and why don't we do this? And so the ability to be able to all play and all sing and all write just created this huge enthusiasm. So we were possessed with this musical spirit that was just waiting to get out.
Right, yeah. I mean, you could tell when you listen to that first album especially, it just the way you guys are sparking off each other is just extraordinary. So let's talk next about how the deal came about with Columbia Records. Cam, maybe you can talk about this, how the deal went down.
Sure. In January of 67, David Rubinson mentioned in an interview that he was going to scout the Sparrow, and he was A&R and producer with Columbia Records, and he was there watching the Sparrow, and Moby Grape were on the bill. They were sharing the bill. So this was in mid-January of 67, and you got interest now from Columbia. There was interest from Atlantic and also interest from Elektra. It really came down to those three labels, and there was a bidding war for the band. And a part of their decision was they were big fans of the Byrds, and the Byrds were on Columbia, and the Byrds partly signed on because Dylan was on Columbia, and also Rubinson's personal excitement. So they had someone who was in-house, who was like their advocate, excited about them, and they went down to LA to record some demos with Columbia in January of 67. They recorded Looper and Indifference on the 25th of January. And then a couple weeks later, they recorded a Peter song, another demo called Stop with Columbia. And so that was down to LA for that. And then they signed with Columbia in February of 67. And they got down to business to recording. Very quickly after that, they had a huge repertoire of songs that they had written and arranged together. And it was just a handful of days in March and April that they recorded that first album.
Right. Okay, so Don, let's, take us there, set the scene. Columbia Studios in Hollywood, right? This is where the first album's going down, and you're playing the material that you'd worked up at the Arc and everything. And at venues up in the Bay Area, what was the atmosphere like? Was it easy to capture that live spirit in the studio?
Well, I think it started at the Palms Motel when we first got down to Hollywood, and we all had our little cabins there, and we were going to go do a recording with Columbia, and David wanted to pick out the song, so he came over, and again, I didn't even realize in a way. I don't want to say how good we were, but I didn't realize in a way what this was going to sound like until David came over and we all just sat down and we completely played unplugged and we sang the whole album for David. And so when we went into the studio, David was so enthusiastic. He knew exactly which songs he wanted to record, which order they should be in. And so when we went into the studio, we were prepared, and having been prepared, I think one of the good things is that, it was like we'd take, a lot of these things were done on one take. We'd just go in and lay down the track, then come out and lay down the vocals. And so it didn't take very long to create that first album in relation to what a lot of albums from a lot of artists take. I think, I don't know, I'd have to ask Cam, how many days were
I think we it was 5 days.
Yeah.
5 days.
Because we were like, we would go in the studio and record a couple of songs, and we'd go off and play a gig for a couple of days, and we'd come back down to the studio and record a couple more songs, and we'd go play another gig and come back and record some more songs. But it was, it never lost any of the momentum or the feel, so it was real fresh.
Right, right. So you would do all the music live, and would you do a scratch vocal and then do a live, a proper overdub vocal?
No, we just go out and sing, and we do the background vocals and the lead vocals all at the same time.
But having done the backing tracks first, or was it the whole thing live?
We'd do the instrumental first.
Right, okay, but yeah, with no scratch vocals.
Yeah, we're one step removed from Little Richard, which I think is like even the better sound, was where they would just put mics into the studio, they'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, everybody would play, and they would sing all at the same time. But this was only maybe one step removed from that. You know, if you take a look at where they've come from then until now, where the last album I did with some of Mellencamp guys and with Jerry and with, you know, people in Tennessee, we never were in the same room.
Yeah.
You know? So this was really, the reason it has that fresh sound is because it was fresh, you know, limited takes and a lot of preparation and ready to go.
Right. Well, let's go through the album track by track, and maybe you can tell me a little bit about, you know, give me your thoughts on each of these songs, and Cam, feel free to chime in. So the first song on the album is Hey Grandma. That's one that you wrote, Don, with Jerry.
Hey Grandma, you're so young.
What do you remember about writing and recording that song?
Well, again, like I said, the people in San Francisco in that time were, it was stunning what was going on. And one of the things that, the girls were just as sweet as could be. And, you know, obviously a young man fancy turns towards those ladies. And there seemed to be a kind of a fad at that time that was called granny dresses. And so they were just kind of like dresses that had a lot of room in them, and girls like had a, you know, a lot of things going on, but those dresses were just like loose and long, and it was a granny dress. And we just thought, hey, Grandma, you're so young. You know, and that's kind of where the title came from. We was looking at these, you know, ladies in their granny dresses. So that's where the song came, the idea came from. It was inspirational. A little patchouli oil, like granny dress, and
right, and that's just a straight-ahead rocker, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just, what more can you ask for?
So, for when you and Jerry wrote together, you know, how was that divided up? Did one of you do the lyrics and one the music, or was it more of a collaboration where you both did a little bit of each?
First off, I've never really written with anybody else, and don't really want to. Maybe one other time I did, but writing with Jerry was just like, from the minute Jerry and I met each other, we were best friends. And so my limited, I'm a drummer, right? So it's like when you play baseball, I'm a catcher. You know, they let drummers hang out with musicians, you know, so I'm a drummer. And, but I hear a lot of music in my head. I can really hear, and I get lyrics. So Jerry and I would come in, or Jerry would come in with an idea. And then I would say, well, what if it goes up to here? And I can play a little bit of guitar, so I would give an idea, and then he would play some great chords. And so I would, you know, I would just come in, and we'd share both on the lyrics and on where the melody would go. But I'd say, I would think the melody should go maybe up to here. And so he'd find a chord, and I'd go, no, that doesn't sound right. What if we, make that into a, you know, make it, I didn't say make it into a ninth, but I'd say make it funkier. You know, so between the two of us, we would, discover some pretty cool, some pretty cool chord progressions and write some pretty cool lyrics. But it was very collaborative. And, you know, so Jerry just was patient with me. And because of that, we were able to, like, you know, be able to write some really interesting songs together.
Right. Yeah. Well, Hey Grandma is definitely a classic. That was just an amazingly great rocker. The next song on the album is Mr. Blues, one of Bob's, of course. What do you remember about Bob bringing that one in and how that one came together?
Well, that was the one where I was just telling you about the background vocals. If you listen to Mr. Blues, it sounds like maybe the Four Tops are singing it in the background. And I love my drum part on that too. But it was so much fun singing the background vocals on that. And Mosley just was, you know, this guy is like handsome as a surfer dude could be, and plays bass like with authority and sings blues better than almost any white guy I ever met. And so Mr. Blues was just right in his wheelhouse. He wrote that song, brought it in, we loved it. And like I said, if you listen to the drum part, it's got kind of a little interesting, some interesting syncopation in it, you know, so it was really, really cool.
Yeah, and he was really like channeling Otis Redding on that song or something. It's an amazing vocal. The next song on the album is one of Peter's, Fall on You, a fast, energetic song.
Well, if you listen to the album, to the kind of the version that has the bonus tracks or whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
you can hear Dave Rubinson, you know, egging me on to play drums.
Don, would you do me one favor just for me? Play that rhythm that you play in the bridge all the way through the tune. Don't tackle, gunkum tackle, gunkum tackle. Just try that. All right, you know what I mean? Just try driving from the top to the bottom, man. Just make the cuts. All right? Because it lifts right off the ground in the bridge, man, and there's a reason for it. You get into a groove and it drives like a motherfucker, and that's where it's at. Okay, stand by. This is 21.
And so that was great because he just got it into the pocket, but it had to just drive like a train on a track that just never came off. And so, you know, he's going, you know, so I just got that thing locked in. And once it started, it just kept rocking. And so, yeah, Peter had a really, really nice song on there, you know, about having all the responsibility and then, or taking all the responsibility and then getting all the blame. It's a pretty good song.
Yeah, and lots of great vocals on that too. Lots of great backing vocals. It's kind of nonstop. You know, you guys are singing and playing nonstop all the way through that song.
Yeah.
Let's talk next about another song that you wrote with Don, with Jerry, and 805, which is just a beautiful love song, farewell song, I suppose. Talk to me about that. What was the inspiration?
Well, the inspiration was our women that were, you know, back up in Washington and missing them, and you know, just that along with some imagination. But the name of it became funny, because it was like it was coming across the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge, and we were driving across the bridge, and Jerry said, "What time is it, man?" I said, 8:05. He goes, "That's really, that could be a cool song." So he goes, "So we're thinking of 8:05, and I guess you're leaving here soon. You know, I can't go on without you. It's useless to try." And so it just became kind of a real lament for the women that weren't with us, and sensing that we might not even get a chance again to be with them. I don't know what's going on. Think you could try? Do you think you could try? And interestingly enough, just a year or so ago, the toll on the bridge at San Francisco is now $8.05.
Is that right? It's beautiful harmonies on that. All the voices just fit together so perfectly.
And I think that's one thing that we learned to do because, like I said, because we were trying to impress each other, and that part never really left, ever, even during difficulties. You know, when we were doing music, we were very attentive to not trying to make things our way, but trying to find the right way. Until I can prove it to you, don't fill my world.
Come in the Morning, another one of Bob Mosley's songs. I mean, you know, what a What a vocal on that song.
And again, that's got the same thing going on. You know, mostly just we're doing four tops and I love my drum part when I look at it from my perspective. But yeah, Mosley's just like singing, you know, he's just singing his ass off. It's really good.
And then we're at Omaha, which is Skip.
Yeah.
And, wow. I mean, can we talk about the intro? What is happening there? That humming sound and the sort of clashing, and then it just kind of steams in at full power, you know? How did you achieve that effect?
Well, I think Skip was like weaponizing music. That song ended up, over the years, being like just like a musical weapon almost. And David Rubinson had the idea for the throwing the beginning of the sound where it goes from, you know, I guess they're calling quadraphonic sound at that time, where it would go from one side to the other side, from the front to the back. And then that pounding lick would come in. So the first part of it was just David, because when we first came in, we just had the, you know, but he put in that intro, which just exploded into the guitar lick.
Yeah, it sets it up so well.
And again, it was just, you know, Skip's energy was like, it was just wonderful, because, you know, the lyrical content is cool, but it's simple, and there's not a lot of it, but it's all just, you know, it's magical.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about the title? What is the true story? Because I heard a couple different versions of how that title came about.
What did you hear?
I think I heard they like stuck a pin in a map or something like that.
Yeah, I think that must be it.
Sounds good. So let's go with that. Is that, do you know?
Sure.
I mean, was it ever explained?
I have no idea. Never explained. But I always thought that, you know, I always thought Manning, when he'd call alternate, you know, signals, when he'd go, Omaha, Omaha. You know, I expect to hear it. I can't believe more radio personalities don't use that as an intro. I mean, it's such a gas.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so much energy in that song. I mean, the drums, I mean, you're going full steam all along, and then it keeps building into these crescendos. And, you know, that must have been... I can't imagine you could do many takes of that.
Yeah, that song basically got us kicked off of our one of our tours that we were on with the Mamas and Papas. Did you know about that? You knew about that.
Yeah, for sure.
Can you tell us about that?
That was in June. After you guys played Monterey, you made the deal to go on a tour with the Mamas and Papas, and you played a couple of shows, but there was a disagreement with the Buckinghams at one point, and you didn't play the last show. It was supposed to be in Pittsburgh, and instead you went to Detroit, and you had a gig at the Rooster Tail Club and some promo for the album. But there was the scuffle. Mama Cass, I think, wasn't happy with your power and volume when you were playing, and so I think a couple of you got chided out by her, and there was the scuffle with the Buckinghams.
So that was all the fault of Omaha. Because
really?
First off, well, it wasn't the Buckinghams. There's a song by Johnny Guitar Watson that they used to do.
Right. Mercy, Mercy, Mercy.
Yeah. So we really kind of, particularly Jerry and I, revered Johnny Guitar Watson, and the Buckinghams version of it just made us kind of like, you know, we weren't the nicest people always. It just made us ill. So we gave them a good shot of our rear ends from the proscenium of the stage. And during that song, so we gave them a nice big moon. And it ended up in a bit of a kerfuffle with them. And then the Mamas and Papas had to follow us, and because they were the headline and we were the next one. And when we did Omaha... if you can imagine, we're doing Omaha and it's going, you know, and then, you know, bam! And then they come out and go, Monday, Monday. And they did not like that. And she didn't care for us at all. And so they actually asked us to, you know, they t- told Columbia they wanted us off the tour. But we went to Detroit and played at the, you know, at Gale Sayers Rooster Club there, and that was great. Skippy got so excited he jumped off the stage accidentally, I guess. You know, he was like, he was doing one of his jump up in the air and running around, and man, he just flew off the stage, you know, because he was so enthusiastic, you know. But we had a great reception at the Rooster Club, and we didn't have to deal with anybody playing Mercy Mercy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like if Pat Boone was singing lead.
I could see that, how that would be torture night after night to hear that, yeah. So the next song on the album is Naked If I Want. It's less than a minute long.
Yeah, that was the shortest song ever recorded on a popular album at the time. And it's just, you know, it's just a song about, you know, it was just so miraculous that we were like doing this, and we didn't know if this could possibly last or if it did or didn't. It didn't really matter. We just wanted an amp and we wanted to play and we wanted to be, you know, we wanted to be in harmony and have a good time. And, you know, if we need something, could we borrow it? And it's just kind of a good old boy song, you know. It's just about, you know, in the midst of all of this, you got to stay humble. You got to realize that you're no big deal. You're just in a situation where a lot of other people could have been. So Naked If I Want To is just kind of an anthem for, you know, for our blue-collar selves.
Right, and you guess it just was a minute because it didn't need to be any more. There was nothing else that needed to be said in the song.
Yeah. Of course, second time we did it, we made it longer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. You redid it. Yeah, on Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're flipping the album over now. And the first song is Someday, which is a collaboration between you, Don, and Jerry, and Skip. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about that one, and you know, who's singing it. I mean, when Bob comes in at the end, that's obviously Bob, and which is a, you know, the hairs on the back of your neck always come up when that part comes in. But you know, who's singing the different parts up to then?
Yeah, when Bob comes in, it's like Mario Lanza. but the thing that was kind of interesting with this was a collaboration. I mean, Jerry and I wrote the song, and Skip helped to add on the bridge. So we just all got into the makings of the song. But Skip and I sang it together. And I've done songs where I go in and redo or overdub on my vocal just to be able to make it a little, you know, not because of it needed, but because I just like the sound of having two voices on there.
Yeah.
So Skip and I sang that together in unison. And we practiced in the hall at the studio in the stairwell, and it sounded so good. But, you know, Skip would say, you know, hey, let's just do this so it sounds like one voice. So I'd say, yeah, let's do that. So I say, let's just go ahead and breathe at the same time and inhale at the same time and look at each other and not miss. So if you listen to it, you can't, it sounds like one voice.
Yeah.
So Skip and I are singing that together. And then Bob comes in, like I said, it sounds like, you know, like, Roy Orbison. So it's a very unusual song, and years later, we couldn't play it anymore. Jerry couldn't figure out the chords. You know, Jerry had a great deal of difficulty figuring out the chord structure to that because it's so unique.
Another one of yours and Jerry's is Ain't No Use, which, I, you know, definitely strong country flavor on that one.
Yeah. I guess that's just us releasing our cowboy, you know, because we both, Jerry and I are big fans of Sons of the Pioneers, and we both really like bluegrass, and we both like Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. That's the kind of folk music that we used to do together all the time. And so Ain't No Use is just a release of that, kind of like just fun as heck to play, fun to write. It's really, really a uplifting song. Ain't no use in saying that I do. Ain't no use in saying that I love you. Cause you know that I know that it's true.
And then another beautiful song by Peter, which is Sitting by the Window.
Pete, I have such strong respect for each of these guys in our band, and still to this day, you know, they all wrote such really great songs. Peter, in a way, is almost my favorite songwriter. He's very, you know, plaintive and philosophical, and manages to put some thoughts together that are really, really profound, you know.
Against my window pane, but just the same, I'm playing my game, and I guess you're playing it too. Go ahead and play it on through.
But what I loved about that was the beautiful way he sang it.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lament. And so his voice was really, really cool. And, you know, in the part where it lifts up, the voices lift up behind him. And then there's some very kind of like real intricate guitar playing. That three guitars, if you listen to it carefully, the guitar playing on that is, that's a perfect example of how three guitars could fit together and, you know, by listening to each other. And it's just really, it's really a nice song. I always love that song.
Yeah, it's amazing that there's three guitars, yet there's still so much space in that song. I mean, that's an incredible feat. Because the atmosphere is beautiful, and the guitar tones, and you know, Mosley's bass line is just, you know, great.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Mike, because a lot of people wouldn't notice the sound that isn't there. And I think you're right. There's a lot of space there for having so many voices and so many guitars, you know.
Yeah, you got to have the space. So that's where the magic happens. And, you know, a wall of sound is nothing, you know, without space. So, Changes, another one by you and Jerry.
Right.
And another fast moving song.
I really love that song, particularly because, you know, I sing and play drums on that. And so it was always great to be able to sing that and play it, because somehow my playing made me want to sing it more, and singing wanted to play it more. But there's a center part in it where it's very powerful, and then builds to a crescendo, and then it's just drums. And if you listen, I loved it when I heard the live version from the Avalon, I believe. And just when the drums come in, it's just like just the whole crowd just goes, you know, because it's just like this powerful instrumental, and then it's just like, you know, my Gene Krupa drumming, you know, managed to like just fill in this space, and then it just comes right back into the vocal with, you know, with the same kind of power that it left. So it was just a powerful, great song.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is the effect on the guitar solo? Is a real, is it like through a Leslie or something like that, or is it just like a tremolo? It's a different sound.
Yeah, Jerry got that sound just with his hands. You know, he never had any of the extra curricular, you know, components to wah-wah pedals or whatever it was in those days and whatever they are now. But he would just play with the volume and squeeze his guitar and bend it, and, you know, he would end up with some amazing sounds.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. Lazy Me is really, it's kind of like the dark horse song of the album for me. It took a few years to kind of creep up on me, and now it's like one of my favorites. You know, that I'll just lay here and decay here. There's some real deep stuff going on there with Bob. What are your thoughts on Lazy Me?
Yeah, it's too deep for me. I love the song. I just, you know, I'm kind of like, same way with you. I think it's the dark horse of the album. When you listen to it, it's like almost like that, you know, like my wife finally got me to watch My Octopus Teacher. I think Lazy Me is the octopus teacher of our album.
That's one way of looking at it, yeah.
Did you ever see that video? Do you ever see that documentary?
No, I have not. I've heard of it.
oh man, it's like, that's just not a, it's a compliment, because this thing turns in such a way, it shows us how loving and powerful it is, but then it comes in so many different shapes and forms, and it's scary, then it's beautiful. And so it's kind of the same way with Lazy Me. It's like, it's all of those things, you know? It's Mosley, man.
Yeah.
What a yeah. dude.
Indeed. And then the last song on the album is one of Skip's, Indifference, another fast one, with a lot of great guitar from Jerry. So, yeah, tell me about that one.
Well, I think Jerry and I, we changed that from what used to be called a slop, and that's a rhythm. You know, so it kind of started out being, you know, what a difference a day is made. So, but Jerry and I are out of the Northwest, and we're real shuffle guys. We love shuffles. And so Jerry just said, hey, why don't we try this like a shuffle? And then suddenly kind of went into, you know, the... So it went into a shuffle beat. And it is kind of, to me, it's like the most uncommercial song, but it's so interesting. And then, you know, then Skip, like, put the slop back in it when Mosley sings. So it goes, it changes from a shuffle into a straight-ahead rock, and then back into a shuffle. And there's some intricate guitar parts in there, you know, but, and Skip, that's the one where Skip, I recall when Skip, he like gets real excited and jumps up and just like goes, you know, just has this great showmanship, you know, and so it used to be like, that song seemed to like really activate everybody in the band, you know. Like I said, I don't think it's very commercial, but I think it's a wonderful song. And so that was... It was a bit of a different genesis to that song.
Yeah, yeah, it's a lot of excitement packed into it. And then I love that coda is kind of like that raga kind of a part. I mean, I wish that went on for like 10 times as long.
Yeah, it's it has got an interesting structure, unusual, really different.
Yeah, yeah, it's a perfect way to end the album, but I just wish that coda kind of went on longer. I always just wanted that to continue.
Yeah, the answering back and forth between Bob and Skip, you know, in the middle section is really, I mean, it's like I'm going, wow, that is just really fantastic. And so a lot of that was, you know, we had the structure and harmonies and everything down by doing it acoustically, but that really came together when we had mics and were able to put it together live. That one we didn't, almost every other song on there was like put together before we got, before we were amplified. That song came together after we were amplified.
Yeah, I can understand that. And you guys are just totally vibing off each other's playing and yeah, the electricity and the volume and everything is kind of, you know, amplifying everything. So, okay, that's the album and... release date, June 6th, 1967. We got to talk about the cover photo, Don, because you're kind of legendary for your finger on the first pressing. Was that just kind of a spontaneous gesture that you did that and that somehow got picked? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, I hate to say this because it just shows what a moron I am. But for some reason, I didn't connect with Jim Marshall. And he was taking us out to do the album covers, and I don't think there was a shot that he took that I didn't give the finger in.
And at what point did everybody notice? I mean, you must have noticed right away, right, when you saw the like a mock-up or whatever. And
well, I think at that point, who was it? Who was the vice president? Rockefeller? No, it wasn't Rockefeller. Gold? I don't know who the hell it was, but I know that the vice president of the United States gave the finger to some college crowd. And so I guess when they saw that, when Columbia saw that, I goes, well, if the vice president can get away with it, you know, it was pretty controversial at the time. So I think when they saw that, and they liked the composition of the picture, it was up at an antique store. And actually, Cam knows more about the story behind that as the location and everything than I do. But because we were just going all over the place. But they liked the composition and yeah. The finger sticking out there. Columbia thought, this... you know, we could cause a little, this could cause a little bit of an uproar, which would be good. And all, you know, publicity is probably good for this band. So, no, was it, that was, where were we? Do you know?
Fairfax, up in Fairfax. Yeah, so they were they were going all over Marin County, and the shot was at Fairfax, a little town a little bit to the north, and there's in front of a shop called the Junk Teak Shop. The building isn't there anymore, unfortunately.
Of course, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the hype. You know, the five singles released at the same time, and that, you know, was perceived as somehow a commercial move. You guys were not somehow authentic because of this. And there was a backlash. I mean, how much of that is true and how much of that is sort of, you know, myth that's been created over the years?
Well, one of the reasons we went with Columbia is one of the things Dave Rubinson said to us. He said, you know what, man? 5 months from now, you're not going to be able to walk down the street in your hometown. He said, we're going to make you guys the American Beatles. That's what's going to happen here. So I can see it in my mind that back in some back room with maybe some cigar-smoking guys, and they're doing the strategy meeting for the launch of Moby Grape, the guy goes, I got a great idea. What do you think of this? Here's what we're going to do. Look, we're going to take this album. There's not a bad cut on this album. What are we going to do? We're going to take one of these songs. I can't tell you how much I love this album. There's so many good songs. Why don't we get this? Get this now. We'll take five separate singles. How's this? We'll do five separate singles. We'll release them all at the same time. It'll be the greatest campaign in the history of music. Five singles all at the same time from the greatest band that America's ever produced. What do you think? Hey, you know, we love it. We love it. Let's do it. That's what happened.
Right.
And what happened is then DJs didn't know what song to play. People thought we were the Monkees, you know, that not to say to be, because I love the Monkees. And I'm not just saying that to be politically correct. I thought I loved their TV show. It was funny. Anyway, so they thought we were the Monkees. They thought we were a hype. You know, it just created a bad feeling among the industry people. You know, I mean, musicians and other people thought, you know, these guys are playing some great music. But just the way that that thing was launched was finished it before it began. And we still sold, I don't know, 500,000 copies or...
You got up to 24 in Billboard. It was on Billboard for 6 months.
Yeah.
Right.
So, whereas... You know, it was very profitable, still sold a whole lot of out, but it never became, you know, it was never, you know, it never became a number one hit or, you know, it never got the airplay on the AM radio or FM that it might have had if maybe Omaha was released as a single or 805 was released as a single. So it became a cluster F.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you should have had that hit single. But you became known as an album band, which is nothing wrong with that, of course. But maybe a hit single would have taken you to the, you know, to the next level, like, you know, The Airplane Had Somebody to Love and White Rabbit, you know, and you could have had that with one of your songs.
I think so. But, you know, it's not regret, it's just that's what happened.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, let's just jump right ahead to what's going on now, because Don, you're still making music, and you know, we won't get into the whole rest of the Moby Grape story, or we're going to have a 3-hour episode here. So, you know, Don, talk about what you're doing today. I mean, how is your music today compared with what you were doing with the Grape? I mean, it's basically, from what I can hear, is a logical progression from there. You're really working in the same area that you always have.
It's funny that I'm a late bloomer. I think I did my first solo album when I was, I don't know, 69. And I did my second one when I was like, yeah, my second one when I was 78 or 79. And now my third one is coming out. And I have like a deep well of songs. And you know, Cam said that. And I think it's kind of interesting is I wasn't really active musically in public or recording for all of my those formative years after Moby Grape. But now, in the last decade... I've become just completely immersed back into music again, and I've met some wonderful, wonderful players. The album before this one that was coming out was, I had Mellencamp guys on it, and a lot of Moby Grape guys, and Burton Cummings came and sang with me, and some great players out of Tennessee. And before that, I did an album with Gordon Stevens, who was on 20 Granite Creek with The Grape. And Jerry came down and spent a week with me in the studio. And then this new one, I've got, somehow I ended up with these producers in Jerusalem who are producing the album and doing the mixing and the mastering and cooperating. And I've had just this great experience. And so I've got 20 songs in the can, and I got two more albums in my head that I want to do. And so it's just been a real blessing to be able to be at this place in my life and just feel filled with music.
That's great that you're still doing it. So the new album is going to be coming out soon. It's called Limited Engagement.
That's right.
Why is it, do you think, that that first Moby Grape album is still the one everyone talks about? It's you know, considered one of the greatest of the era. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's no fillers. I mean, every song stands on its own. And what we spoke about earlier, I think, is part of it also. I mean, if you look at each individual and what talent they brought to this, and if you have, you know, three guitars, you know, five players, five singers, five songwriters, and each of them with probably what you'd call some sort of expertise in what they brought to bear, you know, where they come in to see each other and everybody's like got some real specific gifts. I think that first album is just done it's honest. It's real, it's honest. It was done, just walk in, lay down the tracks, sing the song straight ahead, not a filler song on the album. I think that's kind of why it has that reputation, because it has merit.
Absolutely. Cam, would you pretty much agree with those sentiments? What are your thoughts about that album?
Yeah, I can't put it better than Don. This is I describe it as alchemy in the Moby Grape book, where they had a kind of alchemy that was it was extremely unique. All these things that Don has been describing, from five different people who all had different backgrounds, and they brought these different things to the table and they mixed them, you know, it was magical. And that's why the album stands up. It can stand up next to the best albums ever made.
Absolutely. Well, thanks guys for your time today. I really appreciate it. Been a lot of fun learning more about all of this. One of my favorite records of all time. And now you've given me some new angles to look at it and listen to it.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having us on your podcast. I love your magazine, by the way.
Oh, thank you, Don. Thanks. I appreciate that. The Ugly Things podcast was produced by James Archer and narrated by Mike Stacks. That's me. I've been publishing Ugly Things magazine now for 40 years, covering the best overlooked music of the 1960s and beyond. Don Stevenson's new album, Limited Engagement, is due for release soon. Cam Cobb's book about Skip Spence, Weighted Down, will be published by Omnibus Press in early 2024. You can order the latest issue of the magazine at uglythings.com. That's ugly-things.com. Where you can also order back issues, vinyl, CDs, and books, and read additional articles and reviews. Please subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, and tell your friends. We would also really appreciate it if you became a Patreon supporter. For a small monthly donation, Patreon members get exclusive access to all kinds of interesting bonus content. Your contribution will help us keep bringing you the very best in 1960s beat, garage, psychedelic music. I'd like to send out a personal thank you to our top Patreon supporters: Michael Barbara, Chip Lyon, Rob Brannigan, Stephen Schmidt, J. Paul Rieger, and Leon Jones. Thank you, all of you, for your support, and thank you for listening.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.